Hello, Greg. This is Tuesday, the 20th of April, 1993. And I thought I'd cut a tape for you expanding some of the background material of Level 5. It occurred to me the other day that that while I have this material available, I may as well give it to you, mainly because anyone doing Level 5 will come across this data, but it will take them some time to put it together into a coherent form, and which I've done. It took me some time to do it, so anyone doing the exercises will find this data particularly useful, because it will help clarify the material that shows up. Under this same heading would be the theory material that I gave you on the two recent tapes I sent you. One on the subject of dissociation. Do you recall that material on the subject of dissociation? The tape on dissociation, and the other material I sent you, the other theory material I sent you, on the tape on the subject of unstacking. Do you remember my reply, my resume of the reply on the subject of unstacking? Well, both those tapes, one on the subject of dissociation, one on the subject of the my reply to the subject of unstacking, contained very, very useful background material on Level 5, which I won't repeat, because I know you have the material. I won't bother to repeat it on this tape. Sooner or later on Level 5, it's necessary to jump in at the deep end, so to speak, on this subject of postulates in the universe, and this time is about now on the subject of the theory here, what we're dealing with. I've already said that talked about universes, and a universe, essentially, well, all universes consist of life plus postulates. That's all they consist of. There's nothing else in any universe but life and postulates. Anything else you consider is in there purely an illusion. It's a sleight of hand. There's nothing else in any universe that you could conceive of but life and postulates. So the physical universe in which we live, in which we share, follows that same ruling. It's a universe, and it's based upon a postulate structure. It's based upon certain laws of this universe, and many of the laws, the physical laws of this universe, have been discovered by scientists and so forth, using their measuring equipment and their observations and so forth. But these laws are, the physical laws of the universe, are deductions from the basic laws of the universe. In other words, that the universe is based upon laws very much more fundamental than the laws of physics. And you would have to expand the laws of, you'd have to expand the subject of physics considerably to include the subject of life, before you could expect to uncover the basic laws upon which this universe is constructed by studying the subject of physics. In other words, the subject of physics, as we understand it today on this planet, is far too limited, because it doesn't include the subject of life. And because of that limitation, it cannot encompass the basic laws upon which this universe is constructed. But that doesn't mean that we won't come across these laws when we're working with a person in therapy, particularly when we get into the upper level tech at Level 5. Of course, we're dealing with the very building blocks upon which any universe is constructed. In other words, life and postulates. And Level 5, 5A, 5B and 5C, is devoted to this subject of handling postulates in the mind. So we're very close up against the subject of universes, and what a universe consists of, and what this universe consists of when we're working with Level 5. So it's no real surprise that sooner or later, when a person is working at Level 5, particularly on Level 5A, when he's working with the fundamental, the basic fundamental goals package, deeply to know goals package. Whilst working with that goals package, he will come across the absolutely fundamental law upon which this universe is constructed. I clearly remember the day when I was working, having a session one day some years ago, when it suddenly dropped out the hamper in the middle of the session. There I was working along, and suddenly, bang, I was suddenly in possession of the basic law upon which the physical universe is constructed. There's no great secret about this law. It's just that it's very deeply hidden if you happen not to know where to look for it. The place to look for it, of course, is amongst the goals packages, and particularly on the to know goals package, and the goals package configuration there of the basic to know goals package. You start working with that, and the basic law of this universe is going to drop out the hamper. Bang! It's bound to drop out sooner or later for anyone working on level 5A, which is why I'm mentioning it here. Because it may be a surprise to them. They might come across it and they might not know what it is. And they might think, oh, it's just another postulate. Well, I can assure you that it isn't. The basic law of this universe, as I will give it to you now, is the basic law. And it is provable, demonstrably provable as such, that it is the basic law, because it explains so much of the phenomena that occurs in this universe. But before I give you this basic law, I better give you something which is common to all universes. This law is common to all universes, not just the universe, the physical universe in which we live. And this is that all postulates limit the possible and thereby define the reasonable. Now, that should be written up in letters of fire. Maybe if you can't get it into letters of fire, you should write it up on a postcard and pin it up on your auditing room wall. All postulates limit the possible and thereby define the reasonable. Once you understand that, that proposition, you understand an awful lot about universes. You understand that until a postulate is made, everything is possible. And that any postulate, no matter what it is, limits the possible. For example, if a person says, all right, well, now the law is that no car will travel at more than 80 kilometres an hour on this stretch of road. Well, that's the law. Well, how does that limit the possible? Well, it limits the speed of the cars on that stretch of road, you see. And another example, if you say, well, you make a postulate, say, well, I'll go to Cairns on this weekend. Well, how does that limit the possible? Well, if you're going to go to Cairns, you're not going to go to anywhere else which is not Cairns, are you? You see, so you've limited your options, as they say, or you've limited your possibilities. And no matter what postulate you make, you'll find that any postulate you make will limit the possible. So all postulates, the first thing about a postulate is that any postulate limits the possible. That's its fundamental purpose, is to limit the possible. And now how about this second bit, and thereby defines the reasonable. Now that is really something. Now the subject of what is reasonable in this universe is a terrible puzzle. It's a great puzzle. You can go up to almost anyone and say, well, you know, you get into talk, they talk to you about things and so forth, and people bang the table and say, well, this is reasonable and that is unreasonable. And they talk about what is reasonable and what is unreasonable. But if you say to them, well, what is reason, what is unreasonable, and what is reasonable, they can't define the terms. They'll say, well, they'll give you an example of something which they consider is reasonable, and they'll give you an example of something which they consider is unreasonable. They cannot define reason, reasonableness and unreasonableness, or reason itself. They simply cannot define it. If you were to talk to a physical scientist, you get closer to a definition of reason. If you were to talk to a logician, you'd get even closer to a definition of reason, because logic is the science of reason. But even the logicians don't grasp this fundamental relationship between postulates and reason. At least I think most of them would if you were to give it to them. They say, oh yes, they sort of knew it, but they didn't know it in those words. But the average person simply doesn't understand the subject of reason, doesn't understand what is reasonable and what is unreasonable, although he can he'll give you endless examples of what he considers reasonable and what he considers unreasonable. So all postulates limit the possible and thereby define the reasonable. Now, how does a postulate define the reasonable? Well, this is the way it goes. That which is reasonable is that which is consistent with the postulate. It's really as simple as that. Give it to you again. That which is reasonable is consistent with the postulate. For example, if the postulate is that every house in Australia will have a roof on it, in other words, that the law says that all houses, no house shall be sold without a roof, all houses will have a roof on it, then it's reasonable, if you buy a house, it's reasonable to expect the house to have a roof on it, because it's consistent with the postulate which says all houses in Australia will have a roof on them. See that? And if you was to buy a house and you look up and notice that it hadn't got a roof on it, that would be inconsistent with the postulate, which says that all houses will have a roof on them. And so you could say, well, this is unreasonable, that I should be expected to buy a house without a roof on it. You follow? So that's the connection between reason and the postulate. And there's no other senior definition of reason in this universe. Reason is only that which is consistent with a postulate. That is to say that if there's no postulates, in the absence of postulates, that the concept of reason is meaningless. In the absence of postulates, the concept of reason is meaningless. The concept of reason only has meaning in the presence of postulates. And that which is reasonable is that which is consistent with the postulates. In other words, the postulate defines what is reasonable. It defines it because that which is reasonable is that which is consistent with the postulate. So there's nothing difficult about this. It's a very, very, it's very, very simple. It's so simple, this is. It's so simple that you can almost have to make it more complicated in order to understand it. It's so terribly, terribly simple. But life gets so involved in this subject of what is reasonable and what is unreasonable that it forgets the basics and forgets the simplicities. And so you come up to a person and say, well, what is reasonable? What is unreasonable? What's the definition of reason? And I don't know how many people in Australia you could walk up to and say, well, now, what's a good definition of reason? I don't know how many people say, well, all postulates limit the possible and thereby define the reasonable, and that which is reasonable is that which is consistent with a postulate. You know, you might find somebody else in Australia who would say that, but it's very, very doubtful. Very, very doubtful indeed. I tell you what, I wouldn't have said it until I'd done level 5 of my technology, until I got myself a few yards deep into level 5 and understood about universes and got the basic postulate of this universe out and so forth. I wouldn't have answered that. I didn't know what reason was either. I was just like anyone else. I couldn't relate it to postulates. If you can't relate it to postulates, you can't relate it to anything, because it won't relate to anything else, the subject of reason. Now, can we actually get more precise on the definition of reason than to say that reason is that which is consistent with a postulate? Yes, we can. We can go one little step further than that, and we can define reason as a complementary postulate. Reason is a complementary postulate. Now, how does that come about? Well, that which is most consistent with a postulate is its complementary postulate, you see. You can't get more consistent with a postulate than the complementary postulate to that postulate. So the complementary postulate must be the very essence of reason regarding a postulate. In other words, the most reasonable thing a person wants to be known, say he's operating on the to be known postulate, the most reasonable thing you can do regarding that person is to know him. You see that? That's the most reasonable thing, because that is the absolute essence of the totality of the consistency. That is as consistent as you can get with his postulate. His postulate is to be known. If you adopt a to know postulate, which is the complementary postulate of to be known, then you will be as reasonable as you can get. You will be as consistent as you could get with his postulate. So reason is a complementary postulate in this universe. And that is the most precise definition there is in this universe of reason. It is a complementary postulate. Which tells you immediately that the opposition postulate is as unreasonable as you can get. A person has the postulate to be known, and about as unreasonable as you can be, well, as unreasonable as you can be, is to not know. To not know him. Because it's totally inconsistent with his postulate. His postulate is to be known, and you're directing a to not know postulate towards him. Well, you couldn't get any more inconsistent with his postulate than that. And you couldn't get more unreasonable as far as he's concerned than that. You follow? Now, this definition of reason being a complementary postulate tells you immediately that all games, because they contain conflicting postulates, a game is a contest in conviction and contains opposing postulates. By definition, that is the definition of a game. It's a contest in conviction. There's two people trying to convince each other of opposing postulates. So all games must be unreasonable. Follow? It drops out straight away from the datum that reason is a complementary postulate. If reason is a complementary postulate, then all games are unreasonable. But conflict, there's no reason in conflict. It's an unreasonable activity. It's an unreasonable activity. It might be fun. Games might be fun. But so help me, they're not reasonable. I mean, you've got 22 men in two football teams standing on a football field. They're about to start a game of football. It's not reasonable for them to play this game of football. The reasonable thing to do, if they want to be reasonable at all about it, is at the beginning of the game, one of the men to pick up the ball and run it round and run it down and put it in the opposing goal. You see that? If they're going to play this, if the idea is to get the ball into the goal between those two posts, well, they might as well pick it up, run it down and put it down there, if that's their purpose. It's not reasonable for 11 of them to try and get that ball into that goal net, get that ball into the net, and 11 of them, the other 11, to try and stop it from happening. That is not reasonable. It's not a reasonable act. It might be a lot of fun, but it's certainly not reasonable. See that? So that's just an example of an unreasonable game. Well, it's no more unreasonable than any other game. The fact that the conflict is there, the fact that the postulates are opposing each other, is the very essence of unreason, because reason is a complementary postulate. This tells you right away that when a person comes up to you and says that what we need in our society is more conflict and more competition and so on, that they're also saying that we need more and more unreason. You see that? Because the conflict, the competition and so on, and the opposition, all produces unreason. The more conflict there is, the less reason there is. And so on. I mean, a tremendous amount of data starts to make sense once you understand these basics. But it all drops out of this hamper of all postulates limit the possible and thereby define the reasonable. And the reasonable is a complementary postulate. Okay, now, I could expand that material out considerably, but if once a person grasps it, they can expand it out themselves. It has enormous ramifications so far. Well, I've spoken so far on this tape. But anyway, we'll go on and give the basic postulate of this universe. So here we go. The basic postulate upon which this universe is constructed is, quote, the class of knowable is coextensive with the class of those things brought into existence to be known. I'll repeat it. The class of the knowable is coextensive with the class of those things brought into existence to be known. End of quote. Now that's a pretty big mouthful, that is. I better break that down into little bits, and it will examine it in detail. What do we mean? What do we mean by the class of the knowable? Well, that is the class of those things that it's possible to know. That's all we mean when we say the class of the knowable. We mean the class of those things that it's possible to know. Right, the class of the knowable is coextensive with. Well, that is a technical term. It's not a difficult technical term. It's a term used in logic. It means when we say two classes are coextensive, it's a term a logician would use when he means that the two classes, that the members of these classes are identical in their characteristics. They have identical characteristics. So loosely speaking, we could say, instead of the phrase is coextensive with, we could say is identical with, or is the same as. That would be a looser way to say it, but the precise technical logical way to say it is coextensive with. That is the precisely correct way to say it, that the class of the knowable is coextensive with the class of those things brought into existence to be known. But what is this class of things brought into existence to be known? Well, that is just what it says, the class of things that are brought into existence to be known. So the law says, the basic law of the universe says, that the class of the knowable is identical, is the same as the class of those things brought into existence to be known. That's all it's saying in so many words. That's what the law means. Now, before I go on talking about the basic law of the universe, I want to give you a very, very useful, valid deduction from this law, which is of everyday use in society, and is tremendous use in science, and is well known and so forth. But I'll give it to you as a deduction from the basic law of the universe. Here we go. It's a little bit... I could give it to you in terms of Boolean algebra, but that wouldn't help. It wouldn't make it any clearer either, because the symbolism, unless the person listening to the tape understands the symbolism of Boolean algebra, it would just be just as mysterious. So I'd better give it to you in terms of formal logic, the deduction. So here we go. If the class of the knowable is coextensive with the class of those things brought into existence to be known, then a thing is either knowable by reason of existing, or is not knowable by reason of not existing. Therefore, a thing either exists or it doesn't exist. Therefore, a thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously. Yes, I've just replayed that over. It's not garbled, so no need to repeat it. Not garbled, so that it is exactly straight the way it should be on the tape. Now, this proposition that a thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously just happens to be the basic postulate, or the basic law upon which logic is the science of logic is constructed. The law, according to the textbooks, was first discovered by Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, from 2,000 years ago, when he said that the most fundamental of all philosophical principles is that a thing cannot possess and not possess a quality. Now, certainly Aristotle based his own logic, his grasp of logic, and all his writings on logic and all his subject of logic on that principle. And Aristotelian logic held fast in our society, in the whole of the Western world, for something like 1850 years. So, and it's still all that happened in in 1850, or about 1850 years after Aristotle was, a guy called George Ball, an English mathematician, came along and took that basic principle that a thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously, and used it, expressed it mathematically, and used it as the basis of the algebra of logic, the algebra of the logic of classes, which is called Boolean algebra, and thereby made logic into a mathematical subject rather than a philosophical subject. At least he turned the logic of classes into a mathematical subject rather than a philosophical subject. And but nevertheless, the Boolean algebra is based upon that, exactly that same proposition, that a thing cannot both exist or not exist cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously, which is itself a valid deduction from the basic law of this universe. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting that the basis of logic, the basic of the science of reason, as we understand it in our world, the basis of the science of reason, and it's no different in the Eastern world. The logic of India and China is based upon the same postulate, I can assure you. It's no different. And in other words, that when you start to take propositions apart using that basic law that a thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously, you start to build up a science of logic. When you try and build up a science of logic without that basic law, you end up with a mess. You just end up with a dog's breakfast, and you end up with unreason. You have to have that basic law in there, you see, that a thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously. It's the absolute basic. Aristotle was completely right when he said that the most fundamental of all philosophical principles is that a thing cannot both possess and not possess a quality. Now, one day when I get a bit of time, it's one of these things I mean to do and I keep putting it off, I must sit down and write down the basic law of this universe and see what other valid deductions there are from this basic law. That one is, I know, is a valid deduction, and that produced that thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously produced the science of logic. I'm just wondering what other valid deductions can be made from the basic law, which could be used as the basic for other sciences, for other endeavours, other human endeavours. As I say, I just haven't got around to doing it. It's one of the things I keep meaning to do and haven't done. There's no doubt many other valid deductions that can be made from that basic law upon which this universe is constructed. Now let's examine this basic law of the universe more closely. What is it telling us? Well, it tells us essentially that there's two activities in this universe which are utterly and completely futile. One of these activities is to try and know something which doesn't exist. Now that is the essence of futility, because you simply can't know it unless it exists. If it doesn't exist, it's unknowable. The basic law of the universe says so. So if a thing doesn't exist in the universe, it's absolutely futile to go around and try and discover it. Yet people spend half their lives trying to discover things that don't exist. It's true, they do. Of course, the person believes that this thing might exist, or believes that it does exist, or even believes that it might exist, so they keep searching for it. But nevertheless, if it turns out that the thing doesn't exist, they've wasted their time, because there's nothing there. They won't find it if it doesn't exist. Now, the other futile thing to do in this universe is to try and not know, and go out of your way to not know things that do exist. See, that's the other futile thing to do. For things knowable, if a thing exists, it's knowable. If it doesn't exist, it's not knowable. So you can waste an awful lot of time and get yourself all upset by trying to discover things that don't exist, or trying to not discover things that do exist. In other words, not knowing things that do exist. Which tells you that the basic law of the universe tells you that this whole idea of trying to not know things that exist, it points out the utter futility of it. As Ron Hubbard explained in Axiom 11, you know, the futility of not isness. Yet people do it all the time. You know, they've got this memory, this painful memory, and they spend half their life trying to blot it out of their mind. Well, they're not going to do it, are they? They're just going to make themselves miserable, ruin their health, one way or the other. Why? Well, the basic basic law upon which this universe is constructed says you can't do it. If it exists, it's knowable. And no amount of endeavouring to not know it is going to change that in the slightest. The thing exists, therefore it's knowable. The thing existed at that moment in time in the universe. It may not exist at this moment in time now, but it existed at that moment in time. If you put your attention back to that moment in space and time, you will find that event occurring. So you better know it then. Then you, when you know it, you can then go off and do other things, you see. But while you're not knowing it, you can get yourself into an awful mess. You see that? But this, of course, is basic in the understanding of Scientology, Dianetics and Scientology, that what you resist, you become. You know, what you not know, you end up getting wrapped around your neck. I mean, there's 1,000 ways that Ron has expressed this in Scientology, and quite rightly so, too. Well, again, you see, it's a valid deduction from the basic law upon which this universe is constructed. It gives you the only two futile things in the universe. The first thing is to try and know something which doesn't exist, and the other futile thing is to try and not know something which does exist. Both of them are the essence of futility in this universe. I mean, these things simply aren't a matter of opinion, you know. They're not a matter of which school you go to. You know, it's a matter upon which you're living in a universe, you're acting and working and so forth, totally within a universe, and you're subscribing to the laws of the universe, and the basic law of the universe you're subscribing to tells you that it's futile to try and know things that don't exist, and it's futile to try and not know things that do exist. Yet all of games play contain these two possibilities. When we examine the game, what we call games play, we find the people doing these things. That they try to discover things that don't exist, and they try and not know things that do exist. We find these the all of games. In fact, fundamentally, you would say games. You could say that fundamentally, games play. Gameplay only consists fundamentally of these two futile activities, which is why gameplay fundamentally is a very futile activity in this universe. Actually, there's nothing wrong with playing games as long as you don't have to play them. If you can take them or leave them, they can be fun. But when you have to play them, you're doomed, because you're stuck on this futility. You go into unreason, and you end up just nailing the coffin lid down on you. You're gone. Why? You violated the basic law of the universe. So there's quite a lot that even on a superficial level starts to fall out of this subject of the basic postulate upon which this universe is constructed. We immediately understand what games play consists of and the futility of it. But bear in mind that the basic law of the universe does allow games to occur, you see. The law sets the universe up and says the class of the knowable is coextensive with the class of those things brought into existence to be known. But it doesn't forbid you. It doesn't say that you can't go around and try and know things that don't exist. It doesn't forbid you from trying to not know things that do exist. It allows this to be possible. But you'll never succeed. But it doesn't actually forbid you trying. But the law says you can't make it. But it does allow the possibility of the games to occur. You see, so there's a certain subtlety involved here. But of course, any purpose is any goal, any law, any purpose is a limitation of the possible. And only by limiting the possible is it possible to set up any forms of games play? You have to have some limitation of possible. And that is the basic limitation in this universe, is the basic law upon which this universe is constructed. Now, we know, as a deduction, as a valid deduction from the basic law of the universe, that classes of objects, obey the what's known as the dictum of Aristotle, that in modern terminology would be that a thing either exists or it doesn't exist, and a thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously. And by use of this this proposition, you can formulate a very, very workable logic, which explains the relationships between classes in the of objects and so forth in the universe itself. And this is the subject of logic, logic of classes, Boolean algebra. Don't miss this in the slightest, that the classes of objects in this universe, their logic is totally determined by this proposition: a thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously, which is a direct deduction from the basic law of the universe. It does determine the logic of classes utterly and completely. And it's up to us now to ask this simple question: how about the subject of postulates? Do they obey this exactly the same law that of classes? In other words, a thing either exists or it doesn't exist. Well, how about postulates? Is that true for postulates? And is that the only law that's true for postulates? Well, let's examine it. Well, what we're looking at here is the difference between a postulate and an object. We're trying to see if there's a difference in their nature. Well, now, one immediate difference immediately comes to mind. A postulate, let's take the postulate to know. Well, that can you can start off with a high intensity postulate to know, and it's on a scale, and as the intensity of the postulate lessens, gets less and less and less, and it will go down to a zero point where there's no postulate. Then it will go over the zero point and it'll reappear in the negative. You get a very, very faint to not know postulate, and that to not know postulate could be intensified up to a maximum intensity of maximum to not know. Now, this is different from an object. An object doesn't obey that rule at all. You don't. You've got this lump of rock, you know, and you have it in full intensity, and you reduce its intensity, and you get a point of zero intensity, and then there's no rock. And then it goes into a little minus intensity of a rock, and it goes into more minus until you get a maximum intensity of no rock. No, it doesn't work for rocks. It works for postulate. It doesn't work for rocks. So there's an immediate difference between the postulate and the object and objects in the universe. So we must bear that in mind. Now, is there any other law which applies to postulates which doesn't apply to objects in the universe? Yes, there's one other law which applies to postulates which doesn't apply to objects in the universe. This is the law of the complementary postulate. Now, you'll become very, very aware of this when you start working with postulates at level 5, that complementary postulates satisfy each other and vanish each other. Complementary postulates satisfy each other and vanish each other. Now, what this means is, for example, you put up a to-be-known postulate, and by its side you mock up a to-know postulate, and the two postulates satisfy each other, and they cancel each other out, and they will vanish each other. You will find that the two postulates, after a second or two, will have been gone. And you say, where have they gone to? Well, they've cancelled each other out. You'd have to mock them up again. And if you wanted to hold them in existence, you'd have to continue to create them and hold them in existence. As soon as you let them go, they satisfy each other and they vanish. So there's the law of the complementary postulate. Now, that's a peculiar law to postulates, which doesn't apply to objects in the universe, is that complementary postulates vanish each other, satisfy each other, and produce a mutual vanishment. Now I see I'm getting at the end of this spool, so to just run the tape on at the end of the spool, Greg, and we'll pick it up at the beginning of the other side. Here we are, back on side two, Greg, same date. So we have two laws there which are applicable to postulates, which aren't applicable to classes of objects. And we now must ask ourselves the question, does the law which is applicable to objects, in other words, a thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously, is that applicable to postulates? Well, yes, it is. A postulate cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously. So that obeys the same law as the law of objects and the law of classes. So the objects in the universe, classes of objects and objects in the universe, just obey that one law. One fundamental law, the thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously. But postulates natively obey these three laws. We have the law of the scale, where the postulate goes from maximum plus intensity through a zero point of no postulate down to a minus maximum intensity. We have that law. And the next one is the law of the complementary postulate, whereby a postulate plus its complementary postulate satisfy each other and cause their mutual vanishment. And thirdly and finally, that the postulate cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously. Now, those three laws are the only three laws which govern the behaviour of postulates in the universe. They're the only three laws, there aren't any others. Now, the law of the complementary postulate, the law which says that a postulate plus its complementary postulate satisfy each other and cause their mutual vanishment, has a very important influence on games play in the universe. The effect of this law is as follows, that if you can imagine people playing light-hearted games and so forth, and having a desire to play games, and they want to keep their game going. Every time they happen to accidentally match up with complementary postulates, the game ends. The game simply stops, you see. and postulates vanish. They satisfy each other and they cancel each other out. The postulates disappear. And you can imagine the game player saying, oh damn, I've managed to get complementary postulates again. So after a while in games playing the universe, there's always this tendency to avoiding the complementary postulate situation because it unnecessarily, from the point of view of the game player, ends the game. So this class of both a postulate and its complementary postulate tends to vanish out of games play. That's one of the first things you see in to go out of games play in the universe. The lack of appreciation of the fact that you can end a game by adopting complementary postulates. First of all, it's regarded as a nuisance to end the game because they want to keep the game going to enjoy the sensation of the game to play, and to accidentally in games in the heat of the moment happen to accidentally match their complementary postulates, it ends the game. The game stops, you see, and the game unlocks. So they come to resist or oppose, but to avoid the complementary postulates. And so the effect is to concentrate more and more upon the opposition postulates and less upon the complementary postulates. And the effect of this is to make the game play more compulsive. You follow that? You see how that would be? It follows directly from the law of the complementary postulate. If you go into a game, obviously if you go into a game in the beginning, you know all the laws and know everything about it. You want to play the game. You want to play games. And the one thing you want to avoid is to end the game. You want to get the game started, you see. So you avoid the complementary postulate. And then when the game gets started, the tendency is to forget about, because you're trying to avoid the complementary postulate situation, it tends to go out of game play. And then when you try to end the game, you've forgotten how to do it. I know it sounds silly, but this is the way it comes about. And games play then tends, because of the law of complementary postulates, tends to go from light-hearted, casual, voluntary games play, tends to go into compulsive game play. It becomes compulsive once the players lose the ability to end the game with complementary postulates. And they lose the ability simply because they no longer, in the early days of playing the game, it was a nuisance to end the game with complementary postulates. So they put it to one side and said, we won't use complementary postulates to end the game. Then they forgot about it. And they lost it, you see. They lost the ability. And they then go into compulsive games play. Because once you take the complementary postulates out of the game situation, you're only left with the game situation. You see, you're not left, the complementary postulates have gone. Look, let's put it this way. Let's imagine what we call a postulate set. You see, there's only two postulates in a goals package. There's a postulate plus its negative, plus the complementary postulate plus its negative. That's four postulates. Let's call the postulate X. So there's X and the negative, which is not X. And there's the complementary postulate of X, we'll call that B. And there's not B, which is the negative of B. So there's only X and not X and B and not B. So there's only four classes in the set. There's XB, X, not B, not X, B, and not X, not B. Follow? That's four classes. That exhausts the possibilities of the system. See that? That exhausts the four possibilities. But XB is a complementary postulate class, because X and B are complementary postulates, and not X and not B are complementary postulates. And they're the ones that are avoided. So the tendency is for those to go out of games play, and the game then to consist of just X and not B, and or not X and B. See that? Now, this is a technical term here. It's a technical term, compulsive games playing. It's defined as the state when complementary postulates have vanished out of the postulate set, and the set has been reduced to the two classes of X, not B, and B, and not X. And the two complementary classes of XB and not X and not B have gone out of the set. And that is the technical definition of compulsive game play. The game play is compulsive simply because it cannot be ended. There's no way to end the game at this point because the complementary postulates have gone. The people can't occupy those postulates because they're out of the set. You see, the set's just reduced to the games classes. There's classes 1 is gone, 2 is present still, 3 is present, and class 4 is gone. So you're left with just classes 2 and 3, which are the two games classes. And that is the technical definition of compulsive games play. And that is how games play becomes compulsive in this universe. It stems from the law of the complementary postulate. Now, in terms of the to know goals package, what would this look like, a compulsive games condition? Well, the person's either in a state of must be known, facing an opponent who mustn't know, or he's in a state of must know, facing an opponent who mustn't be known, or vice versa, giving a total of four possible games classes in all. In other words, whichever one of the four postulates in the set he's in, he's facing the opposition postulate. That's another way to put it. The set reduces to two games classes, but there's four possibilities because there's four postulates in the set. So whichever postulate he occupies, he's always facing somebody with. He's always facing the opposition postulate. He's never facing a complementary postulate because they've gone out of the set. Now that is compulsive gameplay. Now there's one other characteristic that goes with compulsive gameplay, and that is that the little other law that goes with the postulates of maximum intensity down to zero point and out through to minus intensity vanishes. that law goes out and simply becomes plus intensity or minus intensity. In other words, the person's in there pitching full steam the whole time, and there's no zero point. There's no point ever where there's no postulate in games played. They're simply all the time they're playing the game. The game is continuous. In other words, there's no point where they stop playing it. They can't stop playing it. You see, it's compulsive. So there's no null point. There's no zero point on the scale for any of the postulates. So that law goes out when we go into compulsive games play. So in compulsive game play, the law of the complementary postulate has gone out, and also the law of the scale, we call it the law of the scale, has gone out. And all that's left is the law of a thing cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously. So the postulate, the law which says that a postulate cannot both exist and not exist simultaneously. In other words, that's the same law that governs the postulates in the universe, that governs objects and classes in the universe. So once the postulate set, it goes into compulsive games play. Once games play becomes compulsive, postulates obey exactly the same law, logically, as do classes and objects in the universe, and can be manipulated as such in a logical system, which is very, very interesting, and so forth. In other words, while we're dealing with compulsive games play, we can use the same logic for postulates as we can for classes. But once we go into non-compulsive games play, voluntary games play, we have to realise that we can't use the same logic for postulates as we can for objects, because the postulates obey two other laws. Now, you understand that? There's our technical basics of what we're dealing with. It would actually be possible to formulate a mathematical logic which allowed for the extra qualities of postulates in the natural native state, including those three, including all the laws that govern postulates. In other words, a logic which governs postulates in non-compulsive gameplay. I'll get some time one day. I might see if I can formulate such a logic. But it's not really necessary to do so, because any logical construct you would need, or I've ever needed, and so forth, dealing with postulates, the application of Boolean algebra to postulates has always been to do with compulsive game play. So I simply treat the postulates as if they were objects and classes of objects, and so forth, and the answers come out right, of course, simply because in compulsive game play the postulates can be handled as if they are objects. The logic is the same. Now, all this might seem very, very far-fetched, and one might be wondering what this has got to do with everyday life and everyday auditing experience and so forth. Well, it does have some very important ramifications. Compulsive game play does allow us to give a tremendous understanding of life. For example, what's the relationships in our XB postulate set when the games play is compulsive, when the XB class is reduced to zero and the not X and not B class is reduced to zero and the set only consists of either X and not B or B and not X? Just what is the relationship between X and B? Well, the relationship between X and B is that X equals not B. That is the relationship between the postulates. Ouch! We have an identification in the set. An identification occurs in the set, in the postulate set, in compulsive games play. Once in compulsive games play is undertaken, there is an identification between two of the postulates in the set. And the identification is between X and not B. X equals not B, and B equals not X. There's an identification in the set. In other words, if the games play became compulsive in the to know goals package, then to know would become, in the mind, would become identical with to not be known, and to be known would become identical with to not know. Now, is there any justification for this? Any application of this? Do we actually see this sort of thing going on in everyday life? Indeed we do. Indeed we do. Let us take an example of the person who is compulsively assertive. He's being known, he's making his presence felt, he's laying down the law, he's thumping the table. Well, if you ever met such a person, been in the presence of such a person, you'll know one thing that this person cannot do, and that is that he cannot know anything. He cannot receive any communication while he's in that state of mind. So he's in a state of must be known and not know. And the two are identified. While he's in a state of must be known, he's in a state of not know. So he can't know, he can't receive any communications while he's in this state of compulsive must be known. So there's an example there. If you ever try to talk to an angry person, you'll see this same thing. He's assertive, he's angry. You can't get through to him while he's angry. He's got to cool down. Once he cools down, then you can talk, converse with him. He will then receive more messages. But while he's in this state of compulsive must be known, he can't receive messages. Simply because must be known equals to not know. The set, you see, is the identification is in the set. All right, let's give another example in the to know goals package. The to know postulate can become compulsive. And when the person becomes compulsive to know, can be associated with the person wanting to hide. We get the example of the old lady peering out from behind her curtains and watching people walking up and down the road. You see, we get the nosy Parker hiding, you see. It's compulsive know, and also compulsive mustn't be known. So must know, mustn't be known. Become the identification there. Also, in the to know goals package, when it becomes compulsive, a person who is in a state of mustn't be known, in a state of hiding, you'll find that they're always furtively looking out to see if anyone is looking at them. Everyone's aware of this phenomena. The person in compulsive hiding. The person is hiding in a house, say, and they've got all the shutters drawn. The urge to pull aside a shutter and peer outside and see if there's anyone looking in is almost irresistible. You see, to not be known is identified, is equal to, is identified with the postulate to know. Finally, in the to know goals package, the person dramatizing to not know, he's highly rejective. Highly rejecting. Well, he's going to be noisy. I don't know if you've noticed this, but you probably have. But all protesters are noisy. I've never heard of people quietly protesting. Well, a protester is dramatizing a not-know postulate, and he does it noisily. There's no such thing as a quiet protester. See, not-know is identical with must be known, and must be known is assertive. So he's asserting his protest. Because the not-know postulate is identified with the must-be-known postulate. So we have plenty of validation of this datum from the basic to-know goals package. And it applies to every other goals package too, I can assure you. It's not peculiar to the to-know goals package. That identification is there in compulsive games play. That X equals not B, and B equals not X. In the postulate set, in the goals package. In terms of propositions, the propositions are: if X, then not B; if not B, then X; if B, then not X; if not X, then B. They are the propositions, if you want it in terms of propositions. And the identification is B equals not X, not X equals B. And X equals not B, not B equals X. They are the identifications in the set. 43 years ago, in 1950, Ron Hubbard published a book called Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health. And in that book, he postulated a thing called the reactive mind. And he said that the logic of the reactive mind contains an identification of A equals A equals A. Do you recall that? In Dianetics, it was one of the foundation stones of Ron's reactive mind theory, was the identification in the reactive bank, A equals A equals A, and the analytical mind, he said, didn't contain this identification. It was free. But the reactive bank was locked into a fixed identification pattern. Now, could it just be that when we look at compulsive game play with the compulsive identification in the postulate set, are we looking at the same phenomena that Ron Hubbard was looking at when he said that the reactive bank contains an identification of A equals A equals A? Could it be? Yes, it is. It is. We are looking at exactly the same phenomena. When we are looking at compulsive gameplay, we're looking at the A equals A equals A of the reactive mind. Now Ron, dear Ron, for all his tremendous qualities as a man, as a researcher, and he was a genius, he was no logician, and he was unable to put the subject onto a logical foundation. I've been able to do this, and been able to put this subject together, and we've got the subject of postulates, and the laws governing the postulates, games play, compulsive games play, and the identification, and we're back where we were. We're now validating Ron's datum of 1950. This is it. This is it. We found it. He never could find it. He could never explain why the reactive bank had an A equals A equals A identification. But now we know why. Why it's in there. It comes from compulsive games play. And we know how games play gets compulsive in the universe from the postulates set. The whole thing now. We've got all the bits. All the bits fit together. We completed Ron's research on the subject of Dianetics in terms of the identification in the reactive bank. So, is it any wonder at level 5 when we erase these goals packages and break these false identifications in the postulate sets at level 5, level 5A and level 5B, we erase the goals packages and break these identifications, that we're just breaking up the reactive mind itself? Yes, exactly. That is exactly and precisely what we are doing. We're breaking up the A equals A of the bank. We're just tearing the bank apart at the level 5. There's a technical name we use for an identification in a postulate set or an identification in any general set, and that is a double bind. I use the term double bind to indicate a false identification. A false identification, a double bind in a postulate set. The term double bind is not original to my own. I first came across the term double bind in a reference to a book written by an anthropologist by the name of Gregory Bateson, who wrote a book in the 1950s, I believe, or around about then, 1940s, 1950s, and he used the term double bind in terms of an identification. He used it. I don't know exactly how he used the term because I never read the book. I've only read references to the book, but I do know he used it in terms of an identification. So I'm carrying on the use of the word when we talk about this false identification, and it is false. I mean, let's face it, in a postulate set, to say that to know is equal to not be known, and that to be known is equal to not know, let's be realistic. These identifications are false. They are false identifications. They are a pack of lies. They are whoppers of the first order. They are false identifications. So when we call these false identifications in a postulate set, we call them double binds. Double bondings, double binds. And one of the prime objects of level 5, level 5A, level 5B, is to break these double binds in the postulate sets, to break them in a reactive mind, to return the reactive mind, return the person's thinking back to the rationality of non-compulsive, non-false identifications. Being able to once again see things as differently, or see similarities and differences between things. What Ron so beautifully explained in Dianetics, that the analytical mind works in differences and similarities, and the reactive bank works in identifications. Now, there's just one final subject I want to cover on this matter of the compulsive game play, and that is the subject of what's called the exclusion postulate. We see that when games play becomes compulsive, that there is always a false identification, that when the person's in one postulate, he's actually in
two postulates, and it's called twin postulate games play. It's compulsive game play or twin postulate game play. He's quite incapable of adopting one postulate. Whenever he adopts one postulate, he adopts its twin, the one it's identified with. So he's always in two postulates. He's in a games postulate, and he's in this other postulate, which is somewhat hidden. But you don't have to search for it very far, but it's there. If he's in a compulsive game, in a state of compulsive gameplay, and we call this other postulate the exclusion postulate. Now, why do we call this postulate the exclusion postulate? Well, simply because it excludes him. It excludes the games player out of the class of the opponent, of the class he's trying to drive the opponent into. In other words, his games postulate is trying to drive the opponent into a certain postulate, and his exclusion postulate keeps him out of that class that he's trying to drive the opponent into. In terms of the to know goals package, if a person was operating on to be known, and the games play was compulsive, his opponent would be occupying to not know, and the if the games play was compulsive, the person who occupying to be known would also be operating on a to not know postulate, but the to not know postulate would be keeping him out of the class that he's trying to drive the opponent into. Now they say, well, what the devil? Why doesn't he want to go into that class? Why doesn't he want to go into that class? Well, it's not particularly obvious in the to know goals package, but let's take a more destructive goals package. Let's take the goal to stab. Now, a person in a stabbing game, he one thing he doesn't want to do, two things he wants to do. He wants to stab the opponent, but he doesn't want to be stabbed. So the game's play is compulsive. He's occupying the class of to stab and to not be stabbed. His game's postulate is to stab, and his exclusion postulate is to not be stabbed. And the postulate to not be stabbed keeps him out of the class of to be stabbed, which is the class he's trying to drive the opponent into. The opponent is standing over there. The opponent's in the class of to not be stabbed, and he's trying to drive this guy from to not be stabbed into to be stabbed. But if he succeeds, the last thing he wants, the games player wants, is to end up in that class himself. You see that? He doesn't want to be stabbed. So we call it an exclusion postulate. That is the best name for the postulate. So when we're looking at compulsive games play, we're looking at twin postulate games play. It's always the second postulate is always there. There's the game postulate and the exclusion postulate. And the exclusion postulate is always identical to the opposition to the games postulate. It's always there. The exclusion postulate is identical to the opposition to the games postulate. In other words, if he's if his games postulate is to stab, the opposition postulate is to not be stabbed. Well, that's exactly what his exclusion postulate will be. So he's in two postulates. Now, one of the reasons I've cut this tape for you is that these exclusion postulates, this twin postulate gameplay, shows up with a vengeance when you start dealing with some of the junior goals packages at level 5B. And it can show up at level 5A. And you start wondering what the hell's going on when you find the person will find themselves in two postulates. So they've got their games postulate, and then suddenly this other postulate turns up, which is the opposition postulate. They're sitting there, they're saying, well, my God, what am I doing with the opponent's postulate? So this is why I'm explaining it. It's an exclusion postulate. This is how I discovered it. It was only later that I put the logic together. First of all, I discovered it empirically. I found it in auditing. I found it in session. Then explained it, the phenomenon. The exclusion postulate. I first realised what it was for, and then I realised there was an identification in the set. And put the set together and got it all out, you see. It all started to come out. That's one of the reasons why I'm cutting this tape. So there's always, when the games play is compulsive, there's always twin postulate games play. There's always two, the person's in two postulates. He's in the gang. He's got a gang postulate. Whatever that gang postulate is, there will be an exclusion postulate which sits there too and keeps him out of the class that he's trying to drive the opponent into. Keeps him out of that class. Or, if you want to put it the other way, that the exclusion postulate is identical to the opposition postulate, to the games postulate. It's identical to the opposition of the games postulate. So we can see two players in compulsive games play, going back to our XB set. The first player is in the class of X, and he's got an X games postulate and a not B exclusion postulate, and the other player opposing him has got a not B games postulate and an X exclusion postulate. And they're the two of a ding-dong at each other. The general rule of compulsive games play, that in any game there's only one games class involved. In other words, there's only two postulates involved between the two players. He's using X as a games postulate and not B as an exclusion postulate, and his opponent is using not B as a games postulate and X as an exclusion postulate. So there's only those two postulates involved in any game. Got two of them. Then they both got the same two, but one of them is using one as a games postulate and he's got the other one as an exclusion postulate, and the other guy's using the other one as the games postulate and he's got the other one as the exclusion postulate. It's a little bit complicated to explain it, but it's very, very simple when you write it down and when you draw it out on a piece of paper. You see the exclusion postulate. You see why I call it an exclusion postulate, because it keeps the person out of the class he's trying to drive the opponent into. When games play becomes compulsive, it can become very undesirable to end up in that class. You might be a person might be committing some pretty nasty overt acts in compulsive games play, and the last place he wants to end up is to be in the class, same class as the person, same class as the opponent is being driven into. You know, like the example of the stabbing. You know, it's all right to go around stabbing people, but it's not all right to be stabbed. Oh, it's all right for Adolf Hitler to kill 6 million Jews, but one thing Adolf Hitler didn't want to be was a dead Jew, one that had just been gassed in one of Hitler's gas chambers. You know, that was an intolerable place for him to be. You see, so there we see compulsive games play. I'm sure Hitler had a very, very, very strong. Very strong exclusion postulate to not be gassed, to not be a gassed Jew. So much for that. The question arises, does this subject of the exclusion postulate, twin postulate games play, make any slightest difference to level 5A, the actual techniques of level 5A practical? No, not in the slightest. Once you become aware that they exist, the twin postulates are there, you do the technique exactly as I've given it. The fact that you're operating on twin postulates doesn't have anything to do with it. You treat them as single postulates and you win every time. So you don't have to do anything about these twin postulates, just know them as theory. Know that they're a part of compulsive game play. But when you take them apart in goals package form at level 5A and level 5B, you do level 5A and level 5B exactly as I've given it. It comes apart that way. It won't come apart any other way, I can assure you. Because the twin goals pack, the twin postulates of compulsive games play is based upon a false identification. It's got a lie built into it. The identification is false. So any attempt to introduce twin postulates into therapy is doomed to failure, because you're simply dramatising the lie. The truth is single postulates. You win at level 5A and level 5B when you work with single postulates. You lose all the time if you try and introduce twin postulates at level 5A and level 5B. So just note that down. I've tried it. I've tested it all. It only works on single postulates. So don't try mucking about at level 5A and level 5B with twin postulates. You just knock yourself into apathy and make yourself miserable. You're just dramatising the lie. Just dramatising the A equals A of the reactive bank. Now, finally, I want to end up with this tape with just a little bit of word on the practical of level 5 here, related to what we've been talking about. When you get some area of the bank or the mind which simply refuses to come apart at level 5, level 5A, level 5B, level 5C, doesn't matter what it is. You find there, you sweat at it, and it simply refuses to come apart, come to erase. Then, cherche le double bind, look for the false identification. You should have that written up on your auditing wall. Cherche le double bind. It's always present. There's always a false identification in there somewhere. You've got a goals package with a false identification in it, with compulsive gain pay in it, and there's a false identification in there somewhere. And that is the cause of why it won't come apart. Now, this is absolutely fundamental. It's the only thing that will stop it from erasing at level 5. There's nothing else that will stop it. You've simply got a false identification in there, and you haven't spotted it. It's in there somewhere. You're going to have to find it. You know, you may get to level 5C. This happens quite often. You get some object there at level 5C. You're trying to erase it, and you can't erase it at level 5C. Well, it's probably associated with a goals package, which has got a false identification in it. You know, the object itself has got itself mixed up in games play with this goals package, and has become important to the goals package, and the goals package has got itself important to the object, and the object is got itself related to this goals package, and the games play in the goals package has become compulsive, and you can't get rid of the object in the mind. Well, what you've got to do, you've got to knuckle down and erase that goals package. Then the object will vanish. You'll erase it easily. There's no exceptions to this rule. If it's not coming apart at level 5A, B or C, there's a double bind. There's a false identification. There's a goals package here somewhere. And you haven't erased the goals package. There's a false identification here. There's a false and it's to do with the goals package. There's a goals package with a false identification in it, which is associated with this area, and it simply won't come apart until you break the identification in the goals package. So don't ask me, try and put me through hoops. Poor Ron Hubbard used to be put through hoops on this. You know, people write in and say, didn't tell you all your techniques wrong, and nothing happened, and poor old Ron had to burn the midnight oil. Well, I'm not going to go through hoops on this one, because I know I've been through the midnight oil myself on this, and there aren't any exceptions. If it doesn't come apart at level 5, then you haven't completed level 5. There's a false identification. There's a goals package in there somewhere with a false identification in it. That's all that can stop it from erasing at level 5. That is very important data. There. It's only this A equals A of the bank, this false identification of compulsive gains play that can prevent erasure at level 5. And that is what level 5 is there to take apart. It needs this powerful technique of level 5 to break this false identification in the goals package. To break it. Only level 5 will break it. But sometimes you get stuck on the false identification and you say, well, level 5 is not enough to break it. Well, it is. If you back it up to in the right area, it's powerful enough to break it. So I don't go... It's no good trying to put me through hoops on this one. I'll simply, you know, if you write to me and say, well, I've tried it all and I've still got this thing, it won't erase at level 5, I'll say, well, just complete level 5. Go back and go through level 5A again. Go and find go back through 5B. Find another goals package. There's one there somewhere. And the chances are that it's one of these goals packages that I happen to know that's got a false identification in it. Like the Tasek goals package. I happen to know that one's got a false identification in it. Ever since human beings adopted gender specialisation, and human beings are born either as males or females, it's got a built-in false identification, that goals package has. So if you get anything associated with sex and it won't erase, well, just erase that, for God's sake, erase that to sex goals package. Then it'll all come apart. I've been through all these hoops myself, Greg, on this one. You know, I've burnt the midnight oil. I've said to myself, Dennis, there's got to be other techniques here that take these things apart, and I can't get this apart. And every time I've said that, I've looked into it further. I've realised I've come across a goddamn false identification of a gold package there, which I hadn't spotted. And once I took the false identification apart, took the compulsive game to apply, he raised the gold package, it all came apart swimmingly. It all came apart exactly as the textbook said. So that's my, I wanted to just say those final words on the subject. It's all there at level 5A, B and C, plus the little bits I've given you, that little addendum I gave you there. It's all there. You don't need any other practical to take the bank apart. I'll say it now, if I ever come up with a level 6, it won't be anything to do with taking the bank apart. It'll be to do with something quite different. It'll be to something to do with the anatomy of creating sensations or something like that. It'll be something quite different from this whole subject of the reactive bank, because as far as I'm concerned, that is a solved problem at level 5 ends that. You start taking the bank apart at level 1, you continue with levels 2, 3, 4, and you finish it at level 5. And when you finish level 5, that's the end of the bank. It's gone. There's nothing else there. There's no bank, no more bank left. That's it. And if there's still bank there, well, then you haven't completed level 5. Now, that's my final words on the subject. I'm not going to be burning midnight oil on the subject. I've done enough burning of midnight oil on my own bank without burning midnight oil on other people's. So I see I'm getting to the end of this tape, Greg, so all the best for now, and ta-da.